This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU and 88.5 WMUB. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. Coming up in about 20 minutes, we'll talk about food for your 4th of July going beyond hamburgers on the grill. We'll now continue our discussion about mental illness. My guests are President and CEO of the Lindner Center of Hope, Dr. Paul Keck Jr. He's also the Executive Vice Chairman of the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine, Department of Psychiatry. President and CEO of North Key Community Care in Covington, Dr. Owen Nichols, and psychiatrist and chief medical officer at Greater Cincinnati Behavioral Health Services, Dr. Tracy Scale. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, email us, talk@wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. You were talking about bipolar disease. One of the things I wanted to ask also, you say it's very easily diagnosable. Has that always been the case? Because it seems we are hearing more about it now. Or is it getting diagnosed more often now?
Yeah, there's a long history in medicine of new treatments being developed driving precision in diagnoses. So, you know, 100 years ago, when there weren't antibiotics for pneumonia, you didn't have to make a distinction between pneumonia and a lot of other lung diseases or even the type of pneumonia and the sensitivity to antibiotics. We pay a lot more attention as a field to the precision of diagnoses when there are more treatments available. Lithium was the first treatment in the modern era of psychiatry in 1949 to be shown to be effective for people with bipolar disorder, then called manic depressive illness. That drove a lot of interest in sorting out and validating the symptoms that defined one illness from another. In the 70s, it became clear that in America, we were overdiagnosing schizophrenia and underdiagnosing bipolar disorder. Why? One reason is that when people are manic, they can sometimes have the very same symptoms that people with schizophrenia have: delusions, hallucinations, very, very disorganized thinking and behavior. But over time, those symptoms improve as their manic or depressive episodes recover, whereas people with schizophrenia, I can let Tracy talk about that. So we now sort of sort those out very carefully because they have very different treatments.
I want to go to a caller now. This is Rebecca from Fairfield. Good afternoon, Rebecca.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
First of all, I thank you for having the panel because this is going on in my life right now. My daughter, as we're speaking, is in with the doctor. He's diagnosing whether or not she has bipolar right now. And I've heard so many different things about degrees of bipolar versus categories of bipolar is one of my big questions. Can someone be a little bit or can someone be a lot? I've heard that before. Are people diagnosed as bipolar when they don't show a large range between highs and lows?
Let's let Dr. Keck answer that one.
It's easy to diagnose bipolar disorder when someone has classic manic depressive illness. The difficulty becomes when the manic symptoms either are not as severe, not as glaring, not as disruptive in someone's life, or don't last very long. Sometimes they only last a couple days. There's a second type of bipolar disorder called bipolar Roman numeral 2 disorder. And that illness tends to be characterized more by depression than by manic symptoms, and the manic symptoms are brief and mild in severity and duration. But that's, if you look hard enough, that can be relatively straightforward to catch. The area where it becomes a much more of a diagnostic challenge is when someone doesn't quite, their illness doesn't read the textbook. They have some change in cycling of mood and behavior that doesn't neatly fit into a category, or especially in kids and adolescents, where the diagnosis is just tougher. Yeah, and quite honestly, that's a bit of the last frontier in diagnostic precision. People are still trying to sort out what's normal adolescent behavior, what's not, and then what other psychological and peer-related things can affect people's behavior.
Right. Can you treat them and see if that helps, and does that help do that, or does treating them if they don't have the disease, can that cause more trouble?
Well, almost all treatments have some side effects, so there's nothing benign about any treatment, purely benign. On the other hand, Sometimes you're left wondering, and sometimes left, and this is true of all of medicine, not just psychiatry, but giving your best guess, explaining to someone, hey, this is my best guess, here's why I think this is a possibility, here are the potential risks and benefits of embarking on a treatment trial, and fortunately, as I mentioned earlier, there are a whole bunch of different options now. And then sometimes, yeah, that treatment is diagnostic. If someone does beautifully, you know, these symptoms that you think might be consistent with bipolar disorder suddenly go away, that helps with your diagnosis.
Rebecca, thanks for your call.
Thank you very much.
I go now to Simon in Richmond. You also had a question about personality disorders, bipolar disorder, Simon.
Yeah, my question is pretty simple. I've known people that have been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. I've also known people that have been diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. And at least from a layman's perspective, they seem to be kind of similar, but I'm sure that that is not really the case. I was wondering if the panelists could explain kind of the differences and similarities between borderline personality disorder and bipolar disorder.
Well, I'll try to tackle that. So you're right. There's a lot of overlap with some people in that, and it can look very similar. With both, there's some affective instability, so their mood becomes unstable at some times, and people with both of those illnesses can get very irritable, can get very high energy, can have sleep disturbances and all of that. What's the borderline personality diagnosis is a character pathology. It's under, whereas bipolar is a mood disorder. That doesn't mean someone with borderline personality can't have changes in mood. That's where a good diagnostician comes into play. A lot will be family history, what's gone on developmentally for that person, has there been trauma in the past, and on and on. And the treatments are quite different. For some of our people with borderline personality, certain therapy modalities tend to work best with them, and sometimes people for transition periods might need medications and sometimes not, whereas many of our patients with bipolar disorder tend to need medications for the long haul. Anything to add?
And, you know, another part of that is if you look at just the mood regulation, there can be an appearance of being very much like one another. So in the diagnostic process, you have to go much further than that. For example, with someone with a borderline personality disorder, you've got to look at their relationships. You've got to look at their attachments with other people. You know, they tend to categorize people as either all or none. Whereas someone that has a bipolar disorder is not going to necessarily make that kind of categorization in their relationships, but still may have all of the instability and irritability of mood that you would see in either one of those individuals. So, it goes back to the level of the diagnostic interview that you're doing and making that kind of fine-tuning interview and diagnostic evaluation.
Simon, thanks for your call. I want to talk a little bit about treatment and what's available. And I think one of the questions that I'd like to find out about is, are these types of diseases treatable and controllable, or are they curable?
That's a great question. As of now, unless there's been some very cutting-edge research going on at the Linder Center of Hope today that I missed, that there are no cures. Is that correct?
That's
we don't have
correct.
Cures. So most of these illnesses are chronic illnesses. I know in terms of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, we think of long-standing treatment for these. We wish there will be a cure. We hope someday there will. All kinds of research is being done to discover, you know, better treatments all the time. For now, we work on trying to decrease the symptoms, whether it's voices or irritability, depression, and help people lead a fulfilling, comfortable life.
But you need to think about that. Would you ask that same question of someone that has hypertension, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, suffers from migraine headaches? With mental illness, we tend to have this cultural perspective that we should be able to cure this and fix it and it should never happen again, whereas we don't do that with other categories of health issues. And mental illness is really no different than any other health-related issue because you have that continuum. Some people respond beautifully to treatment. Some people, it takes a while to figure out what will work with them. And keeping in mind that not every person that goes in that has high blood pressure is going to respond to the first anti-hypertensive med that they're put on.
This is an email from Raina who says there are some people that are aware that something is wrong, but they have not the resources to seek the necessary medical attention. What, if anything, will the impending ACA do to help people be able to seek a psychologist or a psychiatrist when there is a problem and they don't have the method, the means to pay for help?
Well, I'm going to specifically address Kentucky. The Affordable Care Act, one thing that it does, it passed as part of that, the parity law that passed in 2008 was included in the Affordable Care Act. So there's parity now for effective January 1st, 2014, parity for mental health issues and addiction issues. So they should have access to treatment the same as anybody with a physical illness. Fortunately, in Kentucky, we have decided, the governor has agreed to expand the Medicaid program. So just in the 8-county region that North Key covers, the numbers are that that's going to allow another 23,000 people to have coverage under the Medicaid program. And they estimate for the state, it's about 300,000 people will have coverage under Medicaid, and about another 300,000 will have coverage under the health insurance exchange that the state has set up. So it really creates an opportunity for people to get service that have not really been able to afford service in the past, or that even though, like with North Key being a community mental health center, we serve the indigent, that they don't have any coverage and so forth, but this provides a way of providing even more service to those individuals.
And I'll echo that, Owen, because Greater Cincinnati Behavioral, we treat also indigent people and people with Medicaid and various insurances, but now there's open access at our agency, which is very new. Before, you had to go through a mental health access point. Some people still do need to do that. But now if you have Medicaid, you can literally walk in our door and say, I need help, and somebody will be directing you for help that day.
Ron from Cincinnati has a question. Good afternoon, Ron.
Yes, my question actually concerns my understanding is that as far as insurance is concerned, that mental health and physical conditions are to be treated the same. And I had difficulty with an insurance company that gave me all sorts of problems trying to go to see a psychiatrist. For one thing, the doctor that my primary care physician who wanted me to see the psychiatrist referred me to someone, and they weren't on the list. So I went to their website, and when I went to the website, I found that a lot of the doctors on their website were not accepting the insurance. So I called back my doctor.
Can you guys have any insight into that?
Yeah, unfortunately, your experience is all too common, and beneath the promise of what the ACA might bring and improved access that Owen and Tracy talked about, there's a cynicism about this, too. And the cynicism is the Mental Health Care Parity Act guarantees access to insurance. It doesn't guarantee that the insurance is going to be as good as for physical illness.
There was recently, though, about 2 months ago, a court decision in the federal court in Vermont, which we're not in that region. But the decision was is that, one, you can't count visits. And what happens in mental health with insurance coverage so often is they count visits. So you've been in five times, then you get evaluated. Can you go back for your next visit? That doesn't happen on physical health care. So if you've got a hypertension issue and you go in for five visits, no one cuts you off and says you can't go back again. So the court ruled that they had to stop doing that and that they could no longer require a pre-authorization for visits for mental health services. And I think there's going to be an increasing number. Now, the Mental Health Parity Act passed in 2008, and it's taken that long for this to get through a federal court. But I think that you're going to see more and more of those kinds of decisions being made that actually does create parity for mental health and physical health.
Well, let's hope so, Owen. I'm sorry, Paul. Let's hope so, because, Ron, your question is a good one. We see all the time people with private insurance, they'll give a list of doctors, and some of the doctors have moved out of state, some are deceased, some are, you know, don't take patients anymore. And I think that the onus is on the insurance company. You have to go back to the insurance company and say, hey, this list that you gave me is not really a viable list, and they need to come up with some options. But unfortunately, the patient ends up giving up because it's hard to go through that list.
Ron, thanks for your call.
When I called them?
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Could I just say what they told me? They said that unless I was willing to go 40 miles from my house, I live in southern part of Cincinnati, Cincinnati, southwestern part of Cincinnati, unless I was willing to go 30 to 40 miles from my house to the doctor in that area, they wouldn't cover it.
I mean, I'm seeing a lot of head shakes here. That's not uncommon,
It's not uncommon, and quite honestly, it's a problem that's very serious for our community. A lot of people don't appreciate the fact that reimbursement rates for mental health care from third-party payers in this community are in the lowest 5% of the U.S. We have a hard time attracting, recruiting and retaining top clinicians to this community. We have a lot of good people, some of whom are sitting around the table today, but we don't have enough clinicians in very different specialties. And, you know, the good news that I think we've tried to convey today is that there are a lot of treatments now. The goal for many, many people with different types of mental illness is that they can get well, but the problem is access to care.
Thanks so much for your call, Ron. We appreciate it. Bill from Loveland, you had a question today? Bill?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Hello? I'm a clinician within this region, and I just had a question about whether or not I did some reading. I forgot exactly where it was, but read somewhere that somebody was looking at treating depression with scopolamine or with ketamine and having some promising, results with that. Do you guys know anything about those studies?
Well, I just came from a conference where many of the doctors were talking just about that, and some of the doctors were actually doing that on a small scale in their practices. Those are not, Paul was talking about medications having the risks. Those are certainly not without risks associated with it. But right now, I'm only aware of the anecdotal reports. Paul, are you, or Owen, are you aware of any studies with that?
Yeah, the ketamine story is an evolving one, but unfortunately not a definitive one. The research is preliminary, and it has to be regarded right now as an experimental treatment. But there are some very promising preliminary results showing, in particular, a dramatic benefit in people who are very, very suicidal. So there may be something there, but in science we like things to be well established and replicated in more than one study, and that hasn't happened yet.
More questions than we can get to. I thank you so much for your call, Bill. We appreciate it. This is an email, a quick one. We have just a few seconds left from Laura, who asks if you could explain the effects of trauma on the brain, and do you believe that PTSD is often misdiagnosed as a mood disorder?
Well, trauma, we see so much of that. In fact, we really emphasize that when we're doing diagnostics to get the history. And we know, for example, in prison systems, over 90-something% of people that are in prisons, women in particular, have had trauma histories. And with us, it is not uncommon for whatever the diagnosis that there's some kind of trauma history associated with it. It definitely can be misdiagnosed if it's not looked for, but we definitely have to ask the questions when you do see hypervigilance and nightmares and flashbacks and all of that. Anything to add to that?
Just a little, and that is that trauma is very important. It makes obviously sometimes permanent scarring and emotionally in people's lives. It also is very closely related, post-traumatic stress disorders, closely related to mood disorders. And it's uncommon to see somebody with PTSD and not have depression.
I want to thank you all for being here today. One thing I've learned is that we need to have you all back and talk more specifically about a variety of these issues, because we certainly have far more questions than we can get here today. It's been a pleasure talking with you all. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we want to say thanks to our mental illness guests today. Guests have been President and CEO of the Lidner Center of Hope, Dr. Paul Keck Jr. He's also the Executive Vice Chairman of the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine, Department of Psychiatry, President and CEO of North Key Community Care in Covington, Dr. Owen Nichols, and psychiatrist and chief medical officer at the Greater Cincinnati Behavioral Health Services, Dr. Tracy Scale. When we continue the program in a couple of minutes, we'll talk about going beyond the typical picnic foods for this 4th of July. This is Cincinnati Edition.